All right, lesson five is about the restoration movement. We went through the outline that we have on one side of your sheet. The aim of it was to restore the New Testament pattern and the doctrine, life, worship, government, the local church, and God's people. It was a good goal and a good aim. But we're not molded by the restoration movement. We're molded by those principles. That is, those that God's Word sets forth. The desire to understand those, to apply them humbly, objectively, accurately. We have some questions on the lesson that hopefully serve to show practical applications of what we've been looking at. So we did question number one. Let's begin with question number two. If someone teaches a view you've never heard before, what should be your reaction? And what if you've been a Christian 20 years? What should be your reaction?
Be willing to examine the Bible.
Be willing to examine it. That's right. There's some verses I have on my notes that we've already used 100 times. We may use it 100 times before we're finished. But they're very useful passages in guarding us and strengthening us. One is Acts 17:11. What does it say? Examine the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. In that particular case, Paul was in Berea. What kind of church was he preaching in? A Baptist church? What kind of church was it? Nope. Wasn't a Gentile church. Synagogue. When Paul got up and taught there in that synagogue, had they ever heard that before? What he was preaching? They had?
Some, if they had been in other synagogues where he was preaching or they come along, I don't know.
Okay. All right, we have no indication that they had ever heard that before. And then the fact that they examined the scriptures daily to see if the things being said were so would lend support to the idea that this was something new. Now, what if they had taken the position, I'm 50 years old, I've gone to church, synagogue, all my life, I've had excellent teachers. There's no way, after all of these years of Bible study, and evidently they were Bible students, this guy comes in and preaches this message about the Messiah. Never heard that presented. What if that would have been the test, the touchstone, as to whether or not they accepted it? Of course, they would not have become Christians. Now, if we hear something new, might that raise a flag? Sure. You know, if you've studied the Bible for 20 years, you hear something new, that may indeed raise a flag. It may be a good reason to say, wait a minute. I've been studying the Bible all these years. I've sat at the feet of good preachers and teachers in a good congregation. This is something new. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but it may mean you've just never heard it before, and you need to hear it. You need to learn it. Have you ever learned anything new about the Bible after you were a Christian 20 years? Sure. There have been times in my life I thought I knew something, and I'd hear a guy preach, and I might even resist it for a while and go ahead and do my own study. I, that guy's right. And I've changed my mind about some things. So, because it's new, certainly doesn't mean we should take hold of it. It may mean we need to re-examine, but it does not mean we necessarily need to reject it.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
I think also we could add to that, we need to listen carefully to the arguments being presented. What's the argument? Where are the key scriptures? We may always have a tendency to say, well, okay, well, I want to go to my scripture and refute this thing. But what about the scriptures they brought up? What is their argument?
Excellent point, Rocky.
Their position?
Yeah, we have a tendency to do what Rocky said. Okay, I don't know what to do with that, but I got my scriptures over here. You got your scriptures, I got my scriptures. But let's go see if their scriptures substantiate what they're saying. Excellent point. We're talking about the restoration movement. When these preachers and teachers of the restoration movement began to teach the things that Barton W. Stone and Thomas Campbell and Alexander Campbell was teaching, do you reckon that was new to folks?
Yes.
Now, do I agree with everything Alexander Campbell taught? Absolutely not. But those men had the courage to study, and they benefited from the fellows ahead of them and teach. And fortunately, there were people who'd listen, and we are benefiting from their labors. But if something new means it's wrong, then of course the whole restoration movement would have fallen to the ground. Why is the knowledge of the origin and rise of today's denominations valuable to us?
We'll repeat the same mistakes.
That's right. Can you give me a verse that shows that history can be an important teacher? There's several. I've got some written down. You may have one that comes to mind.
Stephen's sermon.
What?
Stephen's sermon in Acts 7.
Okay, that's a good one. I don't have that one down, but that's an excellent one. When Stephen preached, he referred to the history of Israel, and he said, you're doing just like your fathers did. That's an excellent one. And so, which of the prophets did not your fathers persecute? You're doing the same thing. So that's a good one, Sally. One that Jesus talked about his day, about a point in history. In fact, he encouraged them to put that in their memory bank. About a woman. Yes. Luke chapter 17. Remember Lot's wife, verse 32. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he talked about some things in history. And where was the history lesson taken from? 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Remember?
The Old Testament.
The Old Testament. And then Paul said they were written for what purpose?
For
our learning. Right. So there you have it again. So you've got verses that, you know, common sense tells you, like Matt did. If we don't study history, we're doomed to make those same mistakes. But there's a number of verses. You may have others written down that shows the value of learning from history. Okay, we talked about the Reformation movement and the Restoration movement. So here's question 4. Do we need religious reformation today? And however you answer that, explain.
We need religious reformation if we see churches going down the wrong road.
Okay. If we see churches doing or teaching things that are unauthorized, we certainly need reformation. That's indeed correct. What about personal reformation?
Romans 12, Romans 12, 1 John 9.
So many passages. Right. Romans 12 is there. Excellent. Just go over ahead and turn to Romans 12. What word says reformation in verse 2? Okay, renewing is a good word. Not the one I'm looking for, but I can't say that that's bad. That's good. Trans, form. Some of you know what word we get in our language from that word. What is it? Metamorphosis. It's a change. And that's what he's talking about. Now, Sally said churches that are going down the wrong road may need to make a change. Can you think of any New Testament letters where that was exactly what that letter, at least part of it, was addressed to, that this church needs to make a change?
1 Corinthians.
Right. 1 Corinthians, particularly chapter, well, I say, chapter 5, chapter 8 through 10, chapter 11, Lord's Supper. Excellent answer. So that church needed to make some reformation, some changes. Now, I just noted in my notes, not change for the sake of change. Not change because, well, people don't like the old stuff anymore. That's why a lot of churches change. We can't draw people, so we change to draw people. We don't need to change for that reason. Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. This is one of those questions that could be yes and no depending on what you're looking at. Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 15. I wonder when I see ads on TV for churches today and all of the appeal to entertainment and those kind of things, if the fellows that are running those churches have ever read these kind of verses, and if they just ignore them or what, I don't know, or just apply them to one thing, and that is Jesus is the Christ. But look what he says here in chapter 2, verse 15. Stand firm. That sound like moving? Stand firm. Hold your course. And what makes you stand firm? Read the rest of the verse. And hold to the traditions which you were taught. What two sources did he give?
Words and letters.
Word of mouth and letter. Which one do we have? The letter. That's right. And so there's our stand. Hold fast. So why don't y'all change? I'm not ashamed to say I don't change if that's the reason right there. Will you still worship the way your daddy and granddaddy did? Well, yes, if it's according to the pattern. But today, man, we gotta have lights and we gotta have entertainment, we gotta have instruments, and we gotta have this and that. No, you don't. Maybe you do that to draw people, but no, you don't change. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1, he praised them actually. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 in verse 1. I said 1, I want 2. I praise you because you remember me in every way and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. And other verses could be presented. But the idea is, yes, if I personally or if the congregation has deviated from the pattern, there needs to be reformation. But not change for the sake of change or for other purposes. Would you support an effort? Now, this question, you've already said you believe in reformation. This question hinges on that little phrase I have in quotation marks. Would you support an effort to restore the church? And explain. If I got to preach, we need to restore the church.
To what?
Sir?
To what?
To the New Testament pattern.
Which church?
See, right there, that's the answer. What church?
People sitting on the pew.
Can I restore? How is the word church used in the New Testament?
Called out.
Called out? So it's just the called out, just people?
Gather things.
Universal, local.
It's universal.
Assembled.
And local, and assembled, all right? And district. But let's take universal, church universal. That group includes which called out?
Saved.
Huh?
Saved.
The saved? Which one? All of them. That's why we use the term universal. Tell me how I can restore the universal church. I can't. Not one thing I can do to restore the universal church, and it will never go wrong. Why?
The
Lord's the head of it. He rules it. If people go wrong and abandon his teachings, what does he do? He removes them. If people obey the gospel, he adds them. He controls membership. He controls the teaching. That's all in his domain, not mine. I can't restore the church universal, and the church universal will never need restoration. Okay, we said, no, I meant the church local. We need to restore the local church. Next question is, which one? Is it this one? Well, no, we just need to restore the church of Christ. Now, what is that?
Denomination.
Oftentimes, that's exactly what people have in mind. A denomination. We'll talk about that in one of our lessons coming up. A group comprised of churches of Christ that we call the Church of Christ. Bible does it. We do. We need to restore the Church of Christ. Really? What is that? And so I put this on here because sometimes our speaking is vague, and when sometimes what that illustrates is that our thinking is vague. And so we may need to restore a particular church. We may need to restore individuals in it, as Linda observed, which is true. We're talking about the church distributively, the individual people in it. But it's good for us sometimes to stop and think about the terminology we use and whether or not it conveys clear concepts. Any other comments before I get to the last question? All right, number 6. Should we be obligated to prove a practice wrong, or should we be obligated to prove a practice right? We talked about this in one of our classes already.
We should be obligated to try and teach when they're
error.
You should be obligated to try and see when there is error. I agree with that. So how do I know when it's error? When I can prove it wrong?
When you show us
whether
it's authorized.
Find out whether it's authorized. Is it wrong for you to drive your Ford down the grassy area of Interstate 10?
Only during an emergency.
Down the grassy area of Interstate 10. It's wrong? It's against the law?
Yes.
Where does the law forbid it?
When there's signs that they don't drive on the median.
Where it shows where you're authorized to drive.
Where you're authorized. It says no unauthorized vehicles. Did I see a hand? No. Okay. So what we need to do is find authority for what we do. And your answer is a good one, Don. That, you know, we ought to be finding out if things are right or wrong. How do you do it? You find out there's authority for it. You don't have to find a prohibition for it. Okay. And that gets us into a study of authority, but we're not studying that topic right now. It's a good study. We have that scheduled, for next year, I think? We'll talk about that then. Okay. Lesson number 6. Does anybody need a copy of lesson? I know some do. Lesson number 6. Lesson number 6. You got 5. That's what I gave you. Oh, you got 6? That's 5. You want my reader? Anybody else need a 6? All right. When I first ran across this concept and read about it in this little tract right here, remember about something new? That was new to me. But as I read it, it was very impressive. It's written by David Edwin Harrell. A member of the church, gospel preacher, professional historian. And what he did was to, and he's not the only one, on the second part of this lesson, lesson 7, he quotes another fellow, Liston Pope. So it's not unique, Mr. Harrell. It's what historians who study the sociological change in religions have observed. And so, this was written way back in 1972. And of course, 1972, the quote-unquote issues were still very much discussed, I suppose you would say. Things were real raw even yet. But he went and studied, he wrote this from the standpoint that the change that took place that divided churches from the 40s, say, through the 60s, where families wouldn't worship together anymore, churches wouldn't go to one another's meetings, and one group would label the other group, and this division that took place. And so, was it a doctrinal division? Yes. What Mr. Harrell puts his finger on is that underlying that, not just that, other movements in religion. And what I'm concerned about now is not so much last century, but what about today? Is that with the doctrinal changes, underlying that oftentimes is a sociological change. A view, a change in the views in which we think about things. What our priorities are. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this lesson. Certainly not unique to me. I'm not a professional historian. We're not going to rely on Mr. Harrell except to know some of his points, but we'll be turning to scriptures that talk about some of these points as we go through the lesson. So we start out here on the outline. We've got four characteristics of early Christians. And these professional historians point out some of these things, but you can see we've got scriptures here to substantiate it. We're not dependent upon them. Look at Galatians chapter 2. We have on your outline, they believed they had the truth. So you know what the issue here was. The issue was whether Gentiles had to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses to be saved. What was Paul's view? Well, I don't know. I think this is it, but there's no use causing a fuss over it. No, listen, he said, it was because of the false brethren secretly brought in, who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage. But we did not yield in subjection to them for even an hour. Why? So that the truth of the gospel would remain with you. Paul was not on a buddy system. Let's see what my buddies believe. While Paul taught brethren to seek peace if possible, that was not his number one priority. This is it. That the truth of the gospel remain with you. And so you have Acts 15, the debate that took place. And so you can see that Paul believed he had the truth. There was no question in his mind. You say, but he was an apostle. But he's expecting the brethren to have that same confidence. Thus the book of Galatians. And so he's trying to impart that confidence and that truth that he had debated in years past. In Jude 3, what are we encouraged to do? Contend earnestly for the faith. contend earnestly for the faith, which was once for all delivered to the saints. There were those coming in trying to undermine the grace of God and turn it into lasciviousness. He said, contend for the faith. There is a body of truth at the time Jude wrote this that was worthy of fighting for. Contend for the faith. So, I have here willing to debate. If you believe it's the truth strong enough, you're willing to discuss it, to argue about it, if you want to use that term. Early on in the history of the church, in Acts chapter 6, verse 9, some men from what was called the synagogue of the freedmen, including both Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and some from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and argued with Stephen. Now, if they argued with Stephen, what does that say about Stephen? What was he doing? He was arguing. Kind of hard to have a one-person argument, isn't it? So they're arguing. They're presenting reasons for their belief on both sides of this. And it says, but they were unable to cope with the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. And then, of course, they got it in for him. And you know the end result. He was stoned to death. But Stephen put his life on the line to defend the truth, to debate the truth. In the 17th chapter, the book of Acts, in verse 17, Paul comes to this city of Athens, this central place where people from all over with all kind of philosophies and ideas came. What is he doing in verse 17?
Reasoning.
What?
Reasoning with them.
Reasoning with them. He's engaging people in discussion. Reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happen to be present. You imagine the difference in range of the things he heard from the Jews who believed in one God to all these philosophers out there in the world, the Epicureans and the Stoics. It didn't make Paul any difference. He believed he had the truth. And given the opportunity, he stood on Mars Hill of the Areopagus and preached the truth about the one God in a city that everywhere you look, you'd see gods. It'd be almost overwhelming. I'm not going to do any good here. Why do I waste my time? But Paul believed he had the truth about the one God. He was willing to defend it. Of course, in the synagogue with the Jews, he didn't have to argue that. He would have to argue that salvation is through faith in the suffering Messiah. In the 18th chapter of the book of Acts, in verse 28, what was this man Apollos doing?
Confuting
the Jews. Over in they got a private room at IHOP. He confuted them. In public. I don't know if he did any good with the Jews, but he did some good with who? What does the text say? That's right. Verse 27, he helped those who had believed through grace. He strengthened the brethren. Debates can do that. Strengthen the brethren in their faith. We had mentioned in a previous class about reading debates, how it can be helpful. And it can be. I know it has to me down through the years. And so that's what Apollos did. He helped strengthen the brethren. So, being willing to debate our differences. Now, you might think religious men in denominations would be willing to debate, but they are not. When I was in West Texas and held my 9-month meeting there, there was a Methodist preacher who had said something about the elders and the church, and I went to his house to talk to him. I was going to record it. He didn't want it recorded. I was going to challenge him to a debate. I'm just a youngster, 20-something years old, about 27, something like that. This fellow was much older. He had probably been to seminary, not interested in debating. I said, the apostles did. He said, they lived in a dog-eat-dog age. In other words, we're much more refined. That concept is what this lesson's about. Sociologically, it wasn't a matter of turning to the Bible. Sociologically, his thinking would not allow that kind of confrontation. And that's true generally. Once in a while, you will hear a debate. Brother Bruce Reeves, who preaches up in Oklahoma, has had several debates. But you don't hear much about debates anymore. They believe they have the truth, and that's why they're willing to debate it. Are you willing to argue about something that you don't have the data on? If you're not really convinced about it? No, you'd be intimidated. But if you believe you got the truth, okay. And then the second thing is the knowledge of the truth was emphasized. So you got four letters about Jesus. And that's all people want to talk about today. Let's just talk about Jesus. And they're not even united on those four letters. And then you have one letter of history, and people aren't united on that one. And so that leaves you 22 letters to Christians and churches. And what do these letters deal with? Well, we have on the lesson. They have to do with what these people's thinking and practice should be morally, and what their thinking and practice should be doctrinally. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 6. Let no one deceive you with empty words. So when people try to defend their immoral conduct, yes. And in Ephesus they would. Let no one deceive you with empty words. For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. You have to go back and read the verses before to know what he's talking about. These things. It's deeds of immorality. And you go down in this same text to verse 17. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Be easy to be deceived, to be foolish, to be unwise. It's encouraging to have wisdom and know what the moral life of a Christian is. Look, there are churches that you can go to. You can listen to the singing. You can enjoy the show. But they're not going to talk to you about adultery, about gambling, about drinking, about immodest dress. But if we're going to hold the pattern and we believe we have the truth, we ought to talk about those things. 1 John chapter 4. Now that's Ephesians 5, the moral context, but look at 1 John 4, 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. Now down in verse 3, you see what these false prophets were teaching. They had the spirit of the Antichrist. Oh, that's yet to come over in Europe or something. No. It's what they were teaching about Jesus, that Jesus didn't come in the flesh. Now, there was a moral aspect to this Gnostic movement. If it's licentious Gnosticism, they said what you do with your body doesn't count. John deals with that in his letter too. But here he's talking about what they teach about Jesus Christ. And he said, don't believe them, everything you hear. Put it to the test. How can we put anything to the test if there's no body to test with? If there's not a pattern, you know, you say to the butcher, that doesn't look like a pound of meat to me. He said, well, it's a pound of meat to me. How are you going to test it?
Weigh it.
Weigh it. And so I've got my little bag in my pocket. Here, so this is a pound. Weigh it. He said, well, I got one in my pocket. Here, mine. Here's mine. How are you going to test it for sure?
Standard.
You've got to have a standard of measurement. That's how you test it. Here's our standard of measurement. And so he said, test the spirits. And you'll note, he says, verse 6, we are from God. He who knows God listens to us. He who is not from God does not listen to us. And tells you who the us is in verse 14. Did it all the way back in chapter 1. The witnesses of Christ. We have seen and testified the Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Those that are appointed witnesses listen to us. And that's the test. That's the standard. Okay. That's number one. Believe they had the truth. And they debated. And it was taught. There was a way to live and a way to believe. Secondly, they believed themselves to be the one church of the Lord. Would somebody read to me the verse that says there's only one church?
Matthew 16:18
says, I'll build my church. And it's singular, but it doesn't say one church. I agree with you. It's a good passage. Where is it? Ephesians 4 says there's one church. One body. Well, how do you know that's the church?
Ephesians 1:22-24.
That's why we got it on the outline. That's right. Your answer is good, Linda. One body, Ephesians 4:4. What is it? He tells you in chapter 1:22-23 that the way he's using the word body in the first three chapters is to refer to the church. And in chapter 4, these seven ones, there's one body. All right, so one church. But wait, I thought there was a church at Humble and a church at New Canyon and a church in Klein Wood. How can that be then?
Many members in one body.
Are we all church at Humble, and is the church at Humble and church at New Canyon, are we all bunched together? Mark? One ideologically. So the church is an ideological view.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
So the church is just an ideology?
No, that's not what I mean. Simply that they're following one standard in that sense. They make up the one church. They're all following the biblical standard. In that sense, they're all one church.
Okay. That's a true statement. What does one church mean? True. What does one, when you say there's one church, what does that mean? Yes. What is church? What kind of word is that? Collective noun. Right? Right, he added us all to the same body. So this group of people that Mark's talking about, if you were to collect them, if you don't collect them, you don't have a church. If you were to collect them, and that may be what Mark had in mind ideologically, if you're thinking that way, collecting them into a group, that's what the Bible's talking about. It talks about the one church. This one church has one Lord, one God, one Spirit, one hope, one baptism, etc. That group. And so, one church. Now, it's not one church. The Church of Christ Church, and then there's the Baptist Church, but they're not the one church because they're not the Church of Christ Church. It's not that. It's one group of saved people. They didn't say he adds us to that group and we become Christian. That's right. And there's only one group. They're all saved the same way by the same Savior. Have the same hope, etc. All right. So,
First John 5, 18 and 19. What about everybody else? What did John say here?
It's not in that group of people who stand on the foundation truth that Bill referred to. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. What does John say about that in John 5, 18 and 19? 1 John. We know that no one who is born of God sins, but he who is born of God keeps him, and the evil one does not touch him. We know that we are of God, and that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. You talk about narrow-minded. You imagine that if you're a Jew sitting in that audience? Or a Gnostic? Or an unbeliever? Or an Epicurean philosopher? You want to go back to that church? The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. So that's what you find in your New Testament. So we got some questions. Let's see, I don't have time. I wanted to get question 1, 2, and 3, and I didn't get either one of them. So we'll pick up there with C and D, and we're going to deal with questions 1, 2, and 3 on each section right here. So if you haven't looked at questions 1, 2, and 3, if you hadn't done it, do all the lesson. We'll hopefully maybe get through the whole thing next class period. And so look that over, and the Lord willing, we'll talk about that some more in our next class. If we can.